Welcome. Hi, Lasse. Hi, Mariana. I don't know if you are listening exactly right now, but I somehow presume that you are. But if not, it's also okay. Then you can listen to it later. I'm in the radio room, our dear radio room. And around me there is a lot of commotion. There is something going on with speed, and this is a coincidence, but I imagine that it will somehow be relevant for this little broadcast. This is the sixth broadcast in our series of radio proposals, or proposals for radio school. And the last broadcast, which was a week ago, was with Mariana, and I really enjoyed listening to that. So thank you so much, Mari. I heard most of it as it was broadcast live, and then I revisited it 2 days ago as I was starting to prepare a little bit for this broadcast. And in ways that I will return to, this little revisit was a confusing experience. Something happened that changed the course of time. But I will get back to this later in the program. Today's program will follow lines of thoughts that will be both diverging and converging in ways that feels like is a little bit out of my hands. I have, of course, sketched a little map. But it feels like a futile exercise to do this map, because I feel like I'm already a little bit lost. So maybe another metaphor we could use was that I will start digging a hole, and then I'm gonna jump into it, and then we see what happens. You could say that the question for today is a question about time. In the end of Mariana's radio show, she asks, "But what should we do with time?" And I don't know what we should do about time. But what we'll sort of get a little bit into today is that I think there is something deceiving, maybe, in considering radio a time-based medium. this might become more obvious later, but there is something telling me that we have been fooled to think of it as a time-based medium. So I think today is, we can maybe consider it sort of the beginning of a kind of emancipatory process of meditating on radio as existing outside of time, as a medium that exists perhaps in space instead of time, or as a portal between times, as a kind of vehicle for time travels and temporal disruptions. But we will begin somewhere else, of course, otherwise we would never get there. So we will begin with an event that happened a few weeks ago. And this event, I thought, was going to be what I would be talking about today. But it was an event that felt, you could say, significant when it happened. But I think the entirety of the significance was not really apparent at the time. It's revealing itself slowly, especially in the last couple of days, as I have sort of been throwing myself into these temporal deep waters, so to speak. So I will try and describe this event, this occurrence is maybe a better word. What happened a few weeks ago was this. We are having lunch. We are the we that consists of the school. We are sitting at Skaftfell. We are having lunch. The mood, at least my mood, is pretty high. I have had a really good morning. I have been to the Net Factory together with Lotte and Isha, and we have been scheming, I think this was the same day. This is how I'll tell the story. We had been scheming. And scheming together can be very sort of arouse enthusiasm, you could say. I was very enthusiastic about what we had been scheming about. And so we're sitting at lunch with our enthusiasm intact. And at some point, we're sitting at the big table, and at some point, Lotte says to me, "Guess what number is in my hand?" And being very enthusiastic at this moment, I'm up for this. And I am just about to say 37. But then before I say it, Lotte says, wait, let me just send it to you. And so we both wait a little, close our eyes for a second. And then, as I open my eyes, I say, 7. And Lotte takes up her hand, and she opens it. And there is a little domino piece. And it is the numbers 6 and 1 that are facing up. 7. I did not know that Lotte was holding a domino piece in her hand, which is maybe why my first impulse was 37, because there aren't, of course, 37 eyes on a domino piece. I thought it could simply be any number, maybe written on a note. But it was 7, and it was sent to me, and I received it. At this meal, the enthusiasm did not diminish after this occurrence, as you can imagine. It became slightly ecstatic. At this same meal, someone tells me that someone else had told them that those particular days that we were in were such that because of the way that moons and stars and other elements in the sky and in the universe, their particular relation to each other meant that these days were particularly sensitive to psychic transfers, or what we could maybe call telepathy. And while that may be the case, I felt that there was also something else at stake. There was something, there was a kind of conditioning to a psychic openness that we had gone through in the weeks leading up to this day. And this was what I thought I would be talking about today, and I am talking about it, and I will continue to talk about it a little bit more, because I thought that this could be a chance to consider the radio school in the sense of what kinds of conditions the radio could service that would be conducive to telepathy and to the transfer of what we can maybe consider psychic messages. And I think the medium in which this sort of psychic messaging or serendipitous occurrences that we experienced, or maybe we can also call it a kind of magic, can happen, that medium, I think we can call that radio. But as I mentioned, there had been this conditioning, these 5 weeks of conditioning, and I think that has something to do with the way of being together that this place had invited us into for 5 weeks. We live fairly close together, all of us, and since I have been sharing a house with Lotte, there had been you could say ample opportunities for nurturing psychic bonds, and I read a story last week, part of a story that made me think of this, and I'm gonna read this to you as a kind of beginning. The story, the book that I'll be reading from, is called Heavenly Breakfast, an essay on the winter of love, and it's written by Samuel Delaney. And I'll do a brief introduction to it, and then I will read the first 10-12 pages or so, and it's not going to be too long, but it's also not going to be too short, so you can make yourselves comfortable. In this book, Delaney describes living in a commune that began in the end of the end of 1967 in San Francisco, the summer of love, and I guess in the end of that summer and fall, it becomes winter, so the winter of love is the reference in the title. This particular commune, you could say, started because Delaney was part of a band at that time called Heavenly Breakfast. And so it happened that most of the band members moved into this little apartment, plus some more people. And it sort of melted together, the band and the apartment, becoming somewhat indistinguishable. And all of it was kind of known as Heavenly Breakfast, and I think it existed for about 10 years. But what I will be reading from is the beginning of this, and I'll be reading the first part as a way for all of us to be a little bit acquainted with maybe the circumstances, but also the vibe. And then what is maybe significant in terms of us considering the radio as a commune / conditioning for psychic transfers and telepathy. The last part of the reading is maybe most significant, but it we need to have the first part also. So I hope you will bear with me with this. Okay. October's end. Four rooms on the second floor of a Lower East Side tenement. Bathtub in the kitchen. Two pantry-sized rooms railroading off that. And a 15x20 back room, largest in the apartment. When I walked in, Rima, yes, she had chosen the name herself, kissed me on the neck. Dave shouted, "Hey, you got here," and picked me up, arms around my back. "Please put me down." "No, let me show you around the place." "Hey, watch it." I had to hold on to his hair and wrap my legs around his chest to keep from falling. "Put me down." "No." He started walking and bumped his hip on the enamel top cover. "Look, will you? You tell me where we are." His mouth was muffled on my stomach. "I can't see anything." "But then how are you going to..." "Hey!" I ducked. We just went through a door. "This is a room. Hey, don't step on..." I think I just did. "That's a laundry bag full of paperback novels under my right moccasin. I thought your laundry had corners all of a sudden." I ducked again. "This is another room. Couldn't you put me down now?" "No. You'll notice it's painted blue with white..." "Turn left! Left!" A web of leather dragged across my face, brushed against his arms. "That was another door, and this is another room. I don't think there are any more after this one, but I've only been here for 2 months. We sleep in here. Christ, it's good to have you here." "It's good to be here." I pulled his right ear. "Does that mean go right?" "No," I said. "Where to now?" "Guide me back to the kitchen." "Couldn't I just walk?" "I think I ought to carry you a while. I haven't seen you in a week. You smell..." 2 steps left and forward. We got back without accident. In the kitchen, the bathtub cover was off. Water broke over Rima's feet. "Is there anything on the kitchen table?" I looked over my shoulder. A toaster, a US postal scale, a Martin 0018. "The toaster isn't on, is it?" "No." "Okay, here you go." "Hey!" Dave stood up, face red inside, much hair the color of brass shavings. Rima's knees submerged. "Are you going to stay?" She leaned on the edge and began to sing. It was a song that I'd written. Then she said, "It'll be good to have you." Her hair, like some redder metal, fell over the chipped white. Sitting on the red-checked oilcloth, I grinned. She began to laugh. "Yeah, I'm going to stay." Dave crowed and slapped both hands against the door, and Rima's laughter rose to cross and momentarily disappears as it crossed, the sound from the streaming top-tap. Little Dave, back wedged against the pile of cushions in the corner, looked up from his drawing and grinned. Eeyore in the stall, John in the corner stood up, zipped his pants, and came out singing the same song. Dominique, standing on the stool in the middle of the floor, finished replacing the ceiling bulb. It and her smile came on at the same time. Shouldering through the door, as if in answer to Dave's slapping, Joey locked in a carton of peach wine, the back edge hooked over his turquoise belt buckle, his only flamboyance in otherwise conventional dress, brown slacks, white short, sport coat, sneakers. Chip's gonna stay. Hey, you're really gonna stay. Wow-wee, have some peach wine. Rima stood up in the bathtub, fingers, breasts, and knees, momentary waterfalls. Do you want some help bringing your stuff down? Anne closed the icebox door, sank teeth into an apple, came by, handed Rima a towel, and went into the back room. Wine? Joey asked. Peach? Rima said. No, thank you. I don't need any help, I said, and drank from the profit bottle. Thanks. That's really odd-tasting stuff. There were 11 people, all told, in that kitchen. Don't you have any stuff? Dave leaned back against the tub and scratched his hair. Well, that just makes it easier, I guess. For a while, I didn't know if you would come. I didn't know when. With two of the group living here, I said, it would be a little strange if the other two of us only showed up for rehearsals. It could be done. Dave drank some wine, frowned at the bottle, handed it back to Joey, who was saying to Snipper, nobody likes it very much. That's why I bring it around. I can leave half a dozen bottles in somebody's icebox for days, come back, and I know it'll still be there. Did you want some? Dave said, I didn't set the place here up for the group, you know what I mean? I nodded. I mean, I set it up to live here. But, I said, you've asked us all to live with you. Lee is probably going to be here in a couple of days. She will have all four of us here. I looked around at the others. I think, Dave said, musing, that our 2 weeks vacation from rehearsals was a very good thing. Maybe it's what we need to get us together, to get it really intense, now, like, and here. Do you mind, I asked, if this place here becomes the group? No, Dave swayed forward and leaned back again, arms folded. I suppose it would have been perfectly. Little Dave tossed him a paisley cushion. He tossed it back. Perfectly obvious to anyone else. You have a rock group. You have a commune. I guess they're the sort of things that tend to get together. You know, Snipper came up behind Dave's elbow. You rescued me. Dave raised an arm. Snipper stepped under it. I was sitting in that furnished room in Brooklyn. His round glasses flared as he looked up, then cleared from eyelids wrinkled in a grin. And I played my guitar without any amplifier. You know how little sound a solid-body electric guitar makes with no amplifier? I played that guitar all day long. I hadn't seen anybody in 6 weeks, and yeah, and you picked me up and brought me here. He does that, Rima said, hair then head emerging from ruffled terry cloth. Which is my point, Nimba said. What do you want to do? Yeah, what do I want to do? You want to live with the people around you who make it easier for you to do your work, which is make music. Yeah, sure, Dave nodded. I just wish Lee would get here so we could get started. She arrived the next afternoon, with silver flute, double Indian flute, hose pipe, one end stopped with clay, holes punched down its length for a random scale, pan pipes, a transverse flute made of bamboo, about the same length and only slightly thicker than a king-sized beer can, as well as sopranino, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, which Snipper had to stand on a chair to play, recorders, ocarine, kazoo, practice clarinet, nose flute, and shawm. Dominique pushed the red and white checked table to the side. Eeyore got himself seated on the back of the green overstuffed easy chair. Anne took a walk and little Dave went into the back room. In the next 2 hours, the instrumentation that had been sketched out back in Lee's old apartment where we'd last met was finally set. You really gonna stay here, Lee? You wasn't sure for a while. Well, the rent ran out on my place 2 days ago, so I think you're stuck with me, she grinned. Snipper's line was added to the vocals, and it all nestled down nicely. Dave sang lead. Over Dave, I sang Descant, shared once with Lee, sung once alone. Lee and Snipper held fifth and tonic on the last chord, while Dave's voice, then mine, left their suspension to dive through at the third, his first, major, then mine, minor, to plunge into and shatter those reflections. While Snipper was repatching the amplifiers, and Rima was replaying the test tape backward, Joey asked, "What's that one called?" "Dawn Passage," Snipper said. "Which one of you guys wrote it?" I sipped from a jelly jar of hot coffee and raised an acknowledging forefinger. "Music and arrangement." "And the words?" "Marilyn Hecker." "No kidding," Joey said. "Say, why don't you put that stuff down and have some peach wine? That really sounds together." In November 1967, the Second Street apartment became the commune for the now defunct rock group Heavenly Breakfast. By the end of the year, both the commune and the group were Heavenly Breakfast. In the decades since, I've met dozens of people who never visited the breakfast, but either lived in or passed through the Lower East Side that year, and who brought the name up in conversation. It's a small neighborhood with lots of imaginative people. Notoriety spreads quickly. But something about the breakfast, transmittable even through report, made it, for a while, part of many people's personal mythologies. This memoir, then, is basically for myself. Much of what I want to define for myself takes back and highlights from communal situations I've visited or live in over the years since. But this first showed me where, among the memories, to search. I have three notebooks from the period, which from time to time serves as diaries. From them, and from recollection, what can I reconstruct? The breakfast was a core of six, besides Dave, Snipper, Lee, and myself. The Heavenly Breakfast rock group, per se. There was Dave's old lady Rima and Eeyore, who just liked to listen to us rehearse and sometimes played the electric bass. At 21, he had 2 feet on thick black hair, 2 feet of thick black hair, already a quarter gray. Also, he was Dave's business partner. A rock group at the rehearsal stage brings no money in. Outlays are heavy. The commune's income came from dealing drugs, grass, hash, acid from the apartment. This is how things were decided at the breakfast. One afternoon, little Dave, still half asleep, came out of the back room into the kitchen and said, "Okay, I'm gonna mop the floor today. Everybody get out. Go on, get into the back or somewhere, or take a walk. Yeah, all of you, I want to get this place clean. And leave your shoes off when you come back in," Lee added as she got up to go. She was just a breath under 6 feet tall when her hair was pulled back tight in a dull bronze horsetail. "That way we can keep it clean." "Yeah," little Dave said. "Everybody just takes your shoes off when you come in the door from now on." Somebody came in the door. Eeyore put his hands on her shoulder. "From now on, when you come in, take your shoes off at the door, okay?" "Okay," Judy said. "Sure." Little Dave was already running water in the sink pail from under the sink. The shoes off policy was kept up till the breakfast disbanded. We never had anything even resembling an organizational meeting. If you wanted something done, you did it. If you wanted people to do something, you asked them. The goat to do something someone wanted you to do was having to live with that person's discomfort or disapproval if you didn't do it. As close as we lived, that was quite a goat. By this method, the two little rooms were set aside for people who were doing something that required physical solitude. Transcribing music from tapes or instrument, Dave couldn't read music, or working on a vocal line with one other person, or writing music. Later, one of the other rooms became an electronic shop for amplifiers and things when little Dave set up his repair equipment there. Loose wires, hot solder, they needed privacy. The back room was for the dozen plus people actually sleeping there. You bought, slept, kept your instruments, your other possessions there, clothes, books, a crystal of pink quartz, a set of felt-tip pens, some miniature houses with trees and lawns, a suburb that could sit on Lee's belly as she regarded it between her breasts. You didn't go into the back room unless you were sleeping at the breakfast. If you didn't pick up on that pretty fast, or had to be told more than once, you were not a welcome visitor, but a tolerated acquaintance. The heavenly breakfast was not particularly democratic. There was nothing terribly collective about it either, though a good deal of clothing was shared. But the bundles by the bed or mattress you were sleeping on that night were yours. What was in your instrument case was left alone. There was one built-in corner cabinet in the back room with drawers beneath it. That one, little Dave said, is going to be for my drawing stuff. Is it okay if I put my typewriter in there too? Snipper asked. There's room on the side. He was writing a novel that week. Sure. Later, Eeyore started keeping his jewelry there. It became the communal drawer for private property. Because Dave and Eeyore managed the drug dealing and therefore were the only people bringing in money, they paid the rent, $75 a month. Also paid for food, and if anyone needed money for something, he asked them for it. Got it if they had it, didn't if they didn't. But neither of them did much cleaning or cooking. There was an exercise bar across the door from the kitchen to the first little room. Anne, who was a senior at NYU and on the women's tumbling team, and Snipper were taking turns working out naked on the bar. You know, I said to Dave, who had just looked up from his book where he sat on the corner cushions, 3 days ago, when I got here, you know what I was worried most about? Anne's feet went between her arms. She released one hand, rotated. Snipper, spotting her, kept her from bumping the door jamb and recovered going into a crab hang cunt thrust towards us. What? I was worried about privacy. But I've discovered something just since I've been here. It's very difficult to be alone in a room with only 2 or 3 other people. In a room with 15 or 20, though, it's easy. When your facial expression or some body movements hints at the least thought of privacy, there's enough other people to pay attention to so that everyone turns away. And you're alone. Then, as soon as somebody wants to be apart, when his head lifts or his eyes seek, somebody's there. Yeah, Dave grinned. When you've been here a while, you almost get too dependent on that. And while I wondered what he meant, he dropped his eyes back to his book. Anne lifted Snipper back to the bar. He swung from side to side to adjust his grip, then turned over and threw a skin the cat reversed and came back again for a one-legged hang, a thin bag of bone and flesh. But you were more conscious of the bone. So I think I'll leave it here with reading more from Heavenly Breakfast. But the aspects of it, of this, was how things were decided at the breakfast. This ability to somehow nurture circumstances for these, you can call them intuitive decision-making processes, perhaps, or we can call them these telepathic circumstances, where you both know and intuit what is meant and needed, and you pay attention to each other. I guess for the sake of talking about this, we can call it the commune situation. Is something that I think would be fun for us to explore a little bit further in relation to the radio school. How does it become a commune? How can you have a feeling of living together, of nurturing these circumstances for telepathy, maybe. I mentioned earlier that I had somehow both planned and thought that this radio show would maybe end around here, that it wouldn't be too long, that there would be maybe a little bit more of an unfolding or digression into this notion of the radio as commune. And I was preparing that while I was listening to the show that Mariana did last week. What is happening around me right now is that someone enters the door and yells to a group of people, 30 seconds, 30 seconds left. And that's good to know, but we have more than 30 seconds left. I was preparing this radio show as I was listening to Mariana's show from last week. And it was coming together, I thought. My thoughts were coming together. But then Mariana said in the end, what should we do with time? And it was almost... Oh, can you hear the knocking? Someone is knocking. Is that a message, do you think? I think it might have been. What should we do with time? I think that's a really good question. When this question was posed, it made me, you could say, it was a spiraling sensation at first, and it was almost like the question commanded me to have a thought. It commanded me to a particular memory that I was in doubt about, where I had experienced. It was a memory of a book that I had encountered quite some years ago, and it's a short text that I stumbled upon in an old secondhand bookshop, one of those really dusty bookshops, where there's books stashed from floor to ceiling. And I pick up this little pamphlet in this bookshop. And it's a little text by William Burroughs. The text is called The Ghost Lemurs of Madagascar. And I'm not sure how, but the question posed by Mariana brought me to this text, or brought this text back to me. At least I'm sitting with it in my hands right now, as we speak. And I read it yesterday, and I haven't slept much since then, which is maybe why this is going to be a little bit messy from now on. I will start by maybe telling you a little bit about what this text is about, as I read it the first time many years ago after finding it in a bookshop. I read it then as a text. I read it then as a fiction. But I'm in doubt now about what that means, and if it is such a thing. The text that is called The Ghost Lemurs of Madagascar was published in 1987. It was a commissioned text. And the text tells the story of a pirate whose name is not entirely known. He was called Captain Mission. His first name is in no records to be found. But Captain Mission sort of finds job on a ship and goes to sea, and has, before leaving, also these sort of, you know, you can say libertarian ideals. And things happen, the ship is sort of meets other ships, there are conflicts, some ships go down, some do not, and before you know it, Mission is promoted to captain. And with his crew, which is a few hundred people, they end up on the island of Madagascar. And they establish an anarchist commune on this island, you could say. A commune, very libertarian commune of free individuals. And they have some communal structures for how to live together and these things. And it is seemingly going really well, this little community that they have there. They live in relative peace and harmony on Madagascar. And Mission becomes, what you could say, he starts to go on these adventures into the jungle of Madagascar, and there's something there that pulls him and draws him towards the lemurs particularly. He is the lemurs are known as, it says in the text here, that the word lemur means ghost in the native language, and that there were taboos against killing them. And in the anarchist commune, they had also imposed an article that prohibited the killing of ghosts, the penalty of which would be expulsion from the settlement. And there were these stories around these ghosts that were drawing Mission towards them and further into the jungle. And he encountered different sort of architectural elements there that he started living in more and more, spending more and more of his time there. He also starts experimenting with some local hallucinogenic substances. And he has these visions that makes him somewhat realize that his condition as a human is an imprisonment in time, that the human condition is a sort of a temporal prison, that we bind ourselves in time. Whereas other creatures, such as the lemurs, do not exist in time, but in space. They have traveled several million years through time, which, when you don't live in time, is maybe not so much, or at least difficult to talk about. What Mission also learns is that what he is discovering, both with his discoveries of the prison of time and with his activities of establishing a commune where people live peacefully together, he is disturbing an order which will not be tolerated. And I will read a little section here where there are some beings, is that the right word? Some things that enter the story briefly. It's just a hint, and when I read them it was an element of fiction that I didn't pay that much more attention to, but maybe I should have. In a pre-recorded and therefore totally predictable universe, the blackest sin is to tamper with the pre-recordings, which could result in altering the pre-recorded future. Captain Mission was guilty of this sin. He threatened to demonstrate for all to see that 300 souls can coexist in relative harmony with each other, their human neighbors, and the ecosphere of flora and fauna. In a muted, ghostly room, the custodians of the future convene, keepers of the board. Mektup, it is written, and they don't want it changed. If 300 men, then 3,000, 30,000, it could spread everywhere. It must be stopped, now. And another replies, our man Martin is on target, he's quite reliable. And what happens in this text is that someone from the commune kills a lemur. And this act spirals a little bit out of control, and eventually the native population kills off most of the people in the commune because they believe it has been a collective decision to be aggressive towards the lemurs, which is a sacred creature on the island. But what Mission understands is that this is how order, the board's order, the pre-recorded order, is restored. And I would say that this is the plot of the story. But there might be a few sections there that we should pay attention to. Here is a short section describing this lemur experience of time. It says that the lemur people are older than Homo sapiens, much older. They date back 60 million years to the time when Madagascar split off from the mainland of Africa. They might be called psychic amphibians, that is, visible only for short periods when they assume a solid form to breathe, but some of them can remain in the invisible state for years at a time. Their way of thinking and feeling is basically different from ours, not oriented towards time and sequence and causality. They find these concepts repugnant and difficult to understand. Later they are also called the people of the cleft. The people of the cleft, formulated by chaos and accelerated time, flash through 60 million years to the split Time is a human affliction, not a human invention, but a prison. So what is the meaning of 60 million years without time? And what does time mean to foraging lemurs? No predators here, not much to fear. They have opposing thumbs, but do not fashion tools. They have no need for tools. They are untouched by the evil that flows in and fills Homo sapiens as he picks up a weapon. Now he has the advantage. A terrible gloating feeling comes from knowing that you've got it. Man was born in time. He lives and dies in time. Wherever he goes, he takes time with him and imposes time. And there is a description earlier of the lemurs. Here it's a tiny hint, which I will also say I didn't pay attention to, but I will try and read it. It is when Captain Mission is going out into the forest to search for the lemurs. He moved through giant ferns and creepers in green shade without need of his cutlass and stopped on the edge of a clearing. A moment of arrested motion, then a bush, a stone, a log moved as a tribe of ring-tailed cat lemurs appeared, parading back and forth around one another, tails quivering above their heads. Then, whisk, they were gone, drawing the space where they had been away with them. Isn't that a good description? Drawing the space where they had been away with them. But I think you get the gist of this story. And in the beginning, when Mariana's question prompted me and brought me back into closer proximity with the story again, I was not sure what I was supposed to do with it. But then I received some information that made it a little bit clearer. It was information that came to me from the past, an old Facebook message long ago, directing me to the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit. And I don't know why, but I went there after reading the text. And I stumbled upon a document that talks about the Lemurian Time War. And some of the employees at the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit have encountered... I'm having visitors in the room. Have encountered a person that has information, a person that has information that has been shared with the employees from the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit. And the information goes like this. I have these notes scattered on the table and I'm struggling to make sense of them. This is okay. The story, that is the information, begins in 1958. I realize that there are parts of the ghost lemurs of Madagascar that I have left out, and I will return to it, because Captain Mission encounters a book when he is, I don't know if we should say hallucinating or having visions, is probably a better word. He somehow encounters the book, and it is unclear if this book is one that he writes or one that he finds. The book that Captain Mission encounters in the story, The Ghost Lemurs of Madagascar, is called the ghost lemurs of Madagascar. The story that I was reading was by William Burroughs, and it was published in 1987. But the information that I'm sitting with, scattered on the table, says that William Burroughs, in the winter of 1958, visited a library, a private library, from Peter Visparov's private library in New York. He visited December 23rd in 1958. And in this library, Burroughs stumbles upon a book. It is called The Ghost Lemurs of Madagascar. And this is 1958. Burroughs knows and does not know at the same time that he wrote this book. Burroughs knows that he did and did not write the book. The same way that Captain Mission both writes and reads the book. And for Burroughs, it becomes evident that he and Captain Mission are maybe not only related through time, but maybe are each other through time. When Burroughs encounters this book, he enters a kind of a trance, and the witness who has relayed this information says that during the trance, that Burroughs have told him that during the trance, it felt as though silent communication with a ghostly non-human companion had flashed him forward to his life as an old man, several decades in the future. Oppressed by a crushing sensation of implacable destiny, as if fragments of a frozen time dimension were cascading into awareness, he sort of remembered writing The Ghost Lemurs of Madagascar, although it wasn't exactly writing, and his writing implements were archaic, belonging to someone else entirely, in another place and time. Even after his recovery, the sense of oppression persisted, like a new dimension of gravity. The vision had granted him horrific insight to the jailhouse mind of the one god. He was convinced the knowledge was dangerous, and that powerful forces were conspiring against him, that the invisible brothers are invading present time. The episode sharpened his already vivid impression that the human animal is cruelly caged in time by an alien power. This is Burroughs' experience. And let me just maybe relay a little bit, because this text that describes this information relayed by this witness also goes a little bit into this, you could say, this oppression by the one god that Burroughs mentions. It says here that in Burroughs' mythology, the one god universe emerges once the magical universe is violently overthrown by the forces of monopoly. The magical universe is populated by many gods, eternally in conflict. There is no possibility of unitary truth, since the nature of reality is constantly contested by heterogeneous entities whose interests are radically incommensurable. Where monotheistic fiction tells of a rebellious succession from the primordial one, Burroughs describes the one initiating a war against the many. The one god universe is anti-magical, authoritarian, dogmatic, the deadly enemy of those who are committed to the magical universe, spontaneous, unpredictable, alive. The universe they are imposing is controlled, predictable, dead. Power operates most effectively not by persuading the conscious mind, but by delimiting in advance what it is possible to experience. By formatting the most basic biological processes of the organism in terms of temporality, control ensures that all human experience is of and in time. That is why time is a prison for humans. Man was born in time, he lives and dies in time. Wherever he goes, he takes time with him and imposes time. On the one hand, human beings are binding time for themselves. They can make information available over any length of time to others through writing. But on the other hand, humans are binding themselves into time, building more of the prison which constrains their affects and perceptions. These are some of the considerations that becomes apparent to Burroughs after this encounter and after being in this trance that the encounter imposes on him. Burroughs starts to, you could say, know that his books, his writing, understood as fiction, is not an accurate way of understanding them. After this encounter, the writing that Burroughs does is understood as hyperstitions, works that do not describe an existing reality, but brings reality into being. It is a kind of warfare, a magical time war, in which for Burroughs the lemurs of Madagascar plays a crucial role as guides in understanding our entrapment in time, in which the fictions operate as a medium to bring about the kind of existence that does not only exist in time. The lemurs are talked about as initiatory beings, mediumistic familiars or occult doorkeepers. Who returned Burroughs to his lost Lemurian landscapes and to his double, Captain Mission. There is a line when Burroughs talks about the One God universe. He talks about that the task of this, of the keepers of the boat, the One God universe, was in many ways very simple. It reads, to defend the integrity of the timeline. And so I thought that a title for a conversation about the radio school as a medium for magical time war could be, how can we with radio defy the integrity of the timeline? And I think returning to the experience at Skaftville, where we had a clear example of telepathy or psychic transfer across space-time, an experience that broke down the space-time continuum significantly. How can we, with our little school, nurture such circumstances? think this is a question that it would be good to bring with us into the next conversations. Thank you for today. See you next week.